Saturday sun came early one morning, in a sky so clear and blue.
Well, it's a song called Saturday Sun. It's the last track on Nick Drake's first album, Five Leaves Left. And apart from Nick Drake playing piano, it features Tristan Fry playing vibraphone and Denny Thompson playing double bass. And Denny Thompson is one of the caravan, the Waiter Blue caravan, which is currently in Australia. And it's great to welcome you back to the music show. It's lovely to see you. Thank you for coming here.
Fantastic to be back.
Also here, Joe Boyd, who produced the albums of Nick Drake. And I'm also delighted to welcome to the show Crystal Warren, who will be singing for us shortly. Danny, do you remember making that track?
Yeah, I remember most of it pretty clearly, actually, because basically I was terrified because I walked in the studio and there was all these amazing string players from the LSO, you know. And I remember, you know, Nick sitting in the corner and hadn't seen any of the music, and I was a bit petrified that I was going to get all these tough charts to play, you know. So I remember it very clearly, and in as much as I had a word and said, well, these charts are great, but can I also do my own little bits? And they said, yeah, carry on. And, you know, the studio was full of Stradivarius and Guarneri's. Yes. And
so was this the same session where we did Riverman?
Yeah.
Because we did Saturday Sun.
Exactly.
Yes.
Because I remember Riverman, because they gave me this chart and it was in five and it's a beautiful song. And so I was given a bit of freedom to play on it, and I really liked it.
How did you meet Nick Drake the first time?
That was the first time.
You were engaged as a session player?
Yeah.
Right.
Through Joe, because I'd done stuff with, I was working with Pentangle and then Alexis Corner.
Yes.
And doing a lot of jazz stuff. And Joe was at his ear on the ground with that stuff.
So, Joe, did you know that you wanted a jazz bass player or somebody who played jazz? Was that part of it?
I mean, I knew that Danny, I mean, I hired Danny to play with Chris McGregor, a great South African jazz pianist. Mm. But that was after I'd hired him to play with the Incredible String Band and with Nick and a few other things. Because I didn't think of, I mean, Danny had a kind of unique image in Britain then and now.
I was going to say, yeah. it was unique, you know, then, it's even more unique now.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that I thought of him, oh, I want a jazz bass player for this. I thought I wanted Danny, because Danny not only could play, you know, with all these folk musicians, I mean, he was very sympathetic to them, but upped everybody's game, you know, when he came into the studio, because, you know, he was a real pro, you know, and you were a lot of people who you couldn't necessarily say that about, you know, were brought into the studio, and it kind of pulled a session together, not only just the musicianship and the professionalism, but also the, you know, just the lively energy and spirit that Danny, you know, it's very difficult to have a bad session with Danny around.
Nick Drake is well, also a unique figure and was right then at the time. What did you see in him and his songs, would you say, Joe, when you first came across him?
Well, I mean, you can analyze it, but it's only analyzing it in retrospect because one's response to music when you hear it is at a gut level. It's just like, wow, I love this. And then you can afterwards look back and think, why do I love this? Mm. And I suppose looking back, I think, well, one reason I loved it was because I wasn't a huge fan of the kind of white middle-class singer-songwriter genre. Mm. And so I had a built-in resistance. And so the people who got over that resistance had to be kind of unusual.
Yes. And, yes. Nick was seriously middle class, wasn't he? Marlborough, yeah, absolutely, Cambridge.
Absolutely. But he had, I mean, you could hear in his music, you could hear a little bit of Davy Graham and you could hear a little bit of Donovan maybe, and a bit of actually the sort of lighter blues players like Brownie McGee and Josh White. He sounded, you know, I had a little bit of that in there. And, but also Bossa Nova, which I sort of learned later, you could hear a bit of João Gilberto in there, particularly on Riverman. Mm. And, but there was something mysteriously original that didn't sound like anybody else. There was something in the way he shaped a chord, the kind of paths his melodies followed. They were just so sophisticated. And the lyrics, you know, even though they're not self-consciously poetic, they're just so well constructed and the use of vocabulary is so particular that you knew this was a smart, well-educated guy.
Yes, and I mean, whose musical tastes ran to Vaughan Williams and Elgar, and who knew his 19th century romantic poetry. And
also, the thing I discovered many years later after his death, I mean, he used to refer to the fact that his mother wrote songs, but always rather dismissively, and she was very dismissive as well. Well, I just write a few amateur things. And then years later, after they were both dead, I heard a tape of his mother, and I went, oh, those chords on the piano, she played the piano, and those chords on the piano had this very distinctive quality that you could hear Nick was, all those strange tunings he had on the guitar were trying to achieve on the guitar this sound that he obviously grew up with, listening to his mother play the piano, because she had this very, I mean, she was an amateur, so she just found her own way around the piano and had this very distinctive way of voicing a chord.
I think it's well known that Nick Drake was shy, didn't like to perform in public, didn't like to give interviews. Was he personally shy as well, did you find, Danny?
Yeah, it was frustrating for me because it was opposites attract, I think, because I liked him for the person that he was, but very fragile. I found him very fragile and depressed. It's not the word, really. It's sort of shy and introverted, and I'm completely opposite. So we got on just fine. And he asked me to do some gigs with him, but I was working with John Martin at the time and doing some other stuff. And I'd been to one of Nick's gigs, and he just didn't address the audience. He didn't involve himself in the audience. And it just seemed strange to me that someone who wanted to write and play music and was, you know, unique, as we all know by now, just couldn't do it in front of the public. It's like having a painter like Picasso who hid all his pictures under the stairs. It just seemed, you know, I want to be out there. You know, it's not a show-off kind of thing, is that, as a musician. And so we had that kind of relationship, and I used to make him laugh. And I got him up to my house in the country, you know, and I bullied him and I patronised him and I was kind to him and used to give him a hug and try and get him, you know, out of his brain on booze. But none of it worked. And in the end, because, you know, I was young myself and had my own kind of stuff to handle, became too much, and just so I just sort of said, well, you just have to get on with it, you know.
Yes.
And I feel bad about it now. In fact, I said to his sister Gabrielle, I said, you know, I tried everything and I found it very frustrating because I really loved Nick, and John Martin did too.
Well, that song Solid Air,
yeah,
which also features you and Tristan Fry, as it happens, I mean, it is a wonderfully eloquent testimony to the frustration that John Martin felt.
Yeah, and John was like me. He didn't have a lot of patience with people like that who he thought might have been too precious. Mm. But Nick was beyond all that. He was just totally unique. And but in the end, you know, you just have to get on with your own. The important thing I'd like to mention about Nick is that people don't mention the fact, although we hear it now and it's wonderful stuff, wonderful songs, is that was his formative period. He had, you know, he hadn't reached a kind of level and said, well, this is the Nick Drake.
No.
It was all formative and you could hear him progressing.
Yes.
And, you know, it's we don't know what he'd
be
promise,
like. It's promise, isn't it? It's huge promise, but it's...
Yeah.
I think maybe we should hear a song since you've said that. And we're going to hear a song sung, not by Nick Drake, but we're going to hear it sung here in the Music Show studio by Crystal Warren, who is part of Way to Blue. And Crystal, you're going to do a song called Hanging on a Star.
Yes, I am.
Joe, tell us about this song.
After I moved to California in 1971, and he recorded Pink Moon after I left, he just with John Wood, the engineer, producing it. And when I started coming back a lot to London, 73, 74, I saw Nick that winter of 73, 74, and he was in terrible shape. He really seemed kind of to have taken a deep plunge. And I, the only thing I could think of was to, the only therapy that I had at my disposal was to go into the studio. Let's go start another record together. And so we took Nick, John Wood, and I went in with Nick late one night. And it was kind of heartbreaking because here was a guy who, all during those sessions, like for Riverman that Danny was talking about and Saturday Sun, you could shut Nick's monitor off in the control room and just listen to the other players to make sure they got it right, because you knew that Nick would always get it right. Nick never made a mistake. His guitar playing was always clean. His vocals were always in tune. And here this night, he had four songs to record and he could barely play them. And so we put down the guitar tracks and then played them back to him in headphones, and he sang over his own guitar tracks and struggled to do that. And these four songs, I mean, it was partly disturbing because of what we were watching in front of us. And then you listen to the lyrics of these four songs, including Black Eyed Dog, which is obviously an image of death, and Rider on the Wheel, and this song, Hanging on a Star, and it's very clear in a way. I mean, it's a little bit metaphoric, but it's really just, everybody's told me I'm a genius, but nobody's buying my records. You know, people tell me I'm great, but my life is terrible. I'm isolated. I'm not connecting to anyone. And yet people tell me I should be. What's the deal? You know? That, to me, is what this song is about.
And you obviously heard him sing it, as it were, a cappella. You recorded just
yeah,
the
well, over
track,
his guitar so. Part. Yeah, but Crystal's going to sing it a cappella. Yeah. She does it beautifully in the show, and then it segues into a song with a full string section and the band.
Crystal?
Okay. Why leave me hanging on a star when you deem me so high? When you deem me so high? When you deem me? Why leave me sailing in the sea when you hear me so clear? When you hear me so clear? When you hear me? Mm-hmm. Wine, leave me hanging on the stand. When you deem me so high, when you deem me so high, when you deem me so
thank you very much indeed. It's Crystal Warren live on The Music Show, and the Nick Drake song, one of his last songs, Hanging on a Star. And Crystal Warren is part of Way to Blue, the songs of Nick Drake, the show which is currently on tour in Australia. Played the Sydney Opera House last night and is about to pitch up in Melbourne for the Recital Centre. Two other members of this caravan are the bass player Danny Thompson and Joe Boyd, who was the producer of Nick Drake's albums. I know you said, Danny, that it was, you know, promise in and that these are his formative years. I mean, is it too much of a waste of time to speculate on what Nick Drake might have become?
No, I've said, you know, that. Unfortunately, there are many tragedies in the music world, and you can mention them forever, you know. And there are people like Paul Kossoff and Tim Buckley also. And I think we should enjoy the fact that we have this legacy and not imagine what it would be like now. We would never know. And I've often said he could have a minicab firm, you know. We don't know, do we? We can get all romantic about it.
Yeah.
And what I feel also needs to be said is that in these years, we don't have record companies with people with any kind of imagination who see these young talent. Joe Boyd had no kind of certainty that here was my reason to make a bundle of money, you know. And Chris Blackwell at Ireland did for Bob Marley and John Martin. You know, they stick with them and nurture them and help them progress. Whereas nowadays, if you don't sell 100,000 in the first week, you're dumped. You know, so a lot of credit has to go to Joe Boyd and also to the great arrangements of Harry Robinson and Robert Kirby. There was a lot of stuff going on, you know, and Nick was very fortunate, I think, in having that umbrella and having these wonderful people around him, you know. And that's part of my frustration with him, that I wanted to get hold of him and say, listen, you know, there are people that would love to be in this situation. I know it doesn't help when a person is going through depression like that. But, you know, I'm just saying it should be remembered that people like, you know, Joe Boyd and were very important in those days.
And the arrangements which Danny's mentioned, Joe, often surrounding him with just strings, a quartet, an octet of string players. He also knew what he wanted, didn't he? And what he didn't want.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's occasionally the Nick Drake estate or I get, you know, emails or letters from people saying, can't we hear Nick with just, like it is on Pink Moon, without all this clutter of strings and stuff like that, which obviously was imposed on him by some, you know, commercially minded producer.
Yes.
But when I first met Nick, he told me that some of the few gigs that he'd done at Cambridge, in his first year at Cambridge, he played at the May Ball, a couple of May Balls in Cambridge, with a string quartet. Those were his first gigs in Cambridge. Mm. He'd met Robert Kirby, and this was, you know, one of the beginning of the relationship between me and Nick was that I heard this person I thought to be a great songwriter, and I wanted to make a world-class record. And so the idea that he'd worked with some student to put together some string quartets, I didn't even clock that. It was just sort of bounced off me as a piece of irrelevant information. And I hired a professional guy who worked on the James Taylor record for Apple. And we went in the studio, we did three tracks with Nick. And they were just wrong. They just didn't work. And Nick was obviously not happy, but he wasn't saying anything. And he waited until all the musicians had cleared out and I'd paid the arranger and everybody had left. Because in those days, you couldn't hear an arrangement before the session. There was no computers or anything like that. And once everybody had left, John Wood, the engineer, and Nick and I sat in the control room and I said, well, that didn't work. And Nick was so relieved, you know, because he was afraid I'd say, oh, that was great, you know. And then he held up his hand and he said, well, I have this friend in Cambridge and he's pretty good. You know, he's written some arrangements. And, you know, I just didn't like the idea of a student arranger. You know, I just thought, no, this has got to be really first class. But I agreed to go up and meet Robert Kirby. And I went and met him and I really liked him. And I could just see how much affection there was that he had for Nick and Nick's music. And so we did the recording of the first track we recorded was Way to Blue, which was a song I'd never heard before because Nick didn't play it on guitar or piano. It's just something vocal and string quartet. And Robert's arrangement was just fantastic. And I just couldn't believe what we'd and this was Nick. This was Nick's will, exercised in a cautious and shy way, but ultimately getting what he wanted. And then after those two records, he said, the third record, I'm going to do just with guitar, you know. And, you know, so obviously he was, you know, and I thought, this is just suicide. I mean, you know, this is not a good idea for your career to do this stark, simple record. But of course, Nick's ghost has the last laugh because Pink Moon outsells Five Leaves Left and Brighter Later by a reasonable distance.
Why do you think they sell now when they didn't sell at all, really, back then in the early 1970s? Why has Nick Drake's time come?
Well, I think it really started coming within a couple of years after his death. People started writing articles. There was, you know, at the time, I just think people couldn't quite get their heads around it. It didn't fit any category. I saw a review in Melody Maker from 1969, a review of Five Leaves Left, which called it an awkward mix of folk and cocktail jazz. And, you know, you could see that. I could see some idiot saying that. And, and I think just steadily over the course of the 80s, every year, the records sold more and more and more. And one of the nice things that I've heard so many times, anecdotally, is you ask somebody how they discovered Nick's music. And I've heard this, I can't tell you how many times I've heard this story, that they started going out with someone. And after like the third or fourth date or something like that, when things were starting to get possibly serious, the man or the woman, the boy or the girl, would say to the other one, do you know the music of Nick Drake?
And like a test.
Yeah, they'd say, no. And they'd say, well, sit down. And they'd put on a disc of Nick Drake. And somehow the body language and the tone of voice made it clear that if you didn't get it, this relationship wasn't long for this world. And this is how so many people... The ripple spread was through this somebody being very important to someone and kind of bringing a friend, a close friend or a lover into that thing. And that's how it spread.
Yes. Yes. I must ask you, Crystal, because you're obviously were not alive when Nick Drake killed himself or died. We're still not sure really what happened. But so you come along later, another generation. Nick Drake's songs, did they speak to you instantly?
Yes. My initial introduction to Nick was while I was still living in Kansas City, Missouri, my hometown. And I was watching television, and a commercial came on, and it was these young 20-somethings who were driving to some party, and everything was beautiful. The sky was this milky blue, and the whole time they're having this ride, they're listening to Pink Moon. Mm. and I was transfixed by it. You know, anything that enters my ears, it stays, you know, stays in the scary cave that is my head, my mind. And later on that year, I went to a friend's place. I remember it was right around Christmas, and a boy named Pat said that his older brother had just gotten him this album from Nick Drake. It was called Pink Moon, and he didn't like it. And I said, well, put it on, I'd like to hear it. And sure enough, I hear the same song that I heard from that commercial. I said, that's that guy, you know, give me your CD. So I stole it from him and started buying anything else I could get of Nick Drake's. So further down the line, many years later, I end up meeting Joe at a place called the Union Chapel in London. And he asked if I would like to be involved with this. And it was just one of the most surreal moments I've experienced yet, where you have taken in someone's music for so long and are such a massive fan, you know, a follower of it, and then to meet someone who's behind that, you know, it's still pretty kooky. But that's how it got to me, and that's how I couldn't resist being a part of this project.
Crystal Warren, Joe Boyd, Danny Thompson, thank you very much, all of you, for coming in to the Music Show to talk about Nick Drake. It's been good to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good to see you again.
Can you now recall all that you have known? Will you never fall when the light has flown? Tell me all that you know. Show me what you have to show. Won't you come and say if you know the way?